The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to Season 4 of Sci-Fi's The Churn podcast. I'm Anna Marie Cox. I'm on TV a fair amount talking about politics and policy, and I have a political-ish podcast called With Friends Like These. But I've always been a huge fan of science fiction, a lot of which is also about politics and policy. How would people react if X or Y or Z happened? That's a fundamental building block of both genre fiction and real-world lawmaking. And The Expanse is an especially vivid example of what happens when people interested in what-ifs take into account a lot of the factors that our real-world lawmakers don't always pay attention to, whether it's the existence of alien life or scarcity of water. It's also got spaceships and sexy leads and great writing, and all of those are really good reasons to watch the show and listen to the podcast, because we're going to talk about all of it. Joining me in these first three episodes is my friend Dan Dresner, whose background is kind of similar to mine, though he has more degrees than I do. He is a professor at the Fletcher School of International Relations at Tufts University and the author of many books, and he has a column at the Washington Post about foreign policy that used to be called Spoiler Alerts. He also wrote a piece for that column during The Expanse's first season where he called it the best show about politics on television. And he was not wrong. Dan and I are going to tackle the first three seasons in these first three episodes, using each season to talk about a different aspect of The Expanse universe. This episode will use season one to talk about the centers of power, the Earth, Mars, and the Belt. Episode two will use season two to talk about the characters and how they begin to change as the show progresses. And episode three will talk about season three, as well as the ideologies and factions that motivate our characters. But also, a lot happens in each of these seasons, and even the biggest superfan might need a little bit of refreshing about plot arcs. So I am going to give you a very, very brief rundown of the season's most important points before Dan and I talk. Now, how brief is this going to be? These are just the three most important things I think you should know about season one. First of all, there's a thing called the proto-molecule. It's alien, and it's sort of like a weaponized version of Star Trek's the Genesis device. It takes living matter and creates other stuff out of it. Gooey, glowing stuff. It consumes and transforms whatever it touches. No one knows exactly how it works or where it came from, but everyone wants some of it. And who do I mean by everyone? In addition to the Belt's Outer Planets Association, the Earth and Mars, there's a giant corporation, and they're the ones who discovered it, Protogen, hence the name proto-molecule. Much of this season and next season are about the lengths to which all of these entities will go to have some of it. So, that brings us to the second point. These entities will go very far to have some of that proto-molecule. They will commit murder, go to war. And for Protogen's owner, Jules Pierre Mao, the sacrifice of his eldest daughter, Julie. Her, well, it's not really a death. It's sort of a disappearance or maybe a contamination by the proto-molecule. Anyway, she disappears from the scene for sure, and her disappearance prompts the involvement of a crooked but ultimately romantic private security detective, Joe Miller. Miller's search for Julie is what winds up threading the entire plot together, from who is trying to manipulate Earth and Mars into war to the nature of the proto-molecule to the uprising of the OPA. He also becomes a quasi-welcome guest on the Rocinante. You know what the Rocinante is, the Rossi. The Rossi is a former Martian warship that was, you could say, was rehomed by the reluctant heroes of the series, Jim, Naomi, Alex, and Amos. Now, Jim Holden, is the most heroic and most reluctant of all of our characters. When the crew of the Rossi and Miller discover that Protogen is going to use the proto-molecule to infect the entire asteroid city-state of Eros, there's no question that Holden will go there to try and stop it. And Miller, he goes because he's fallen in love with the idea of Julie Mao. Eros is not saved. For Jim, that gives him a core mission of destroying every trace of the proto-molecule in the known galaxy. And Miller becomes motivated by a desire to take up Julie Mao's cause. He will fight for the belt, and he'll fight to avenge her. That's the emotional landscape of one small corner of the expanse. Now, let's pull very far back, and talk bigger, and biggest picture with Dan Dresner. Dan, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Anna. Thanks for having me on.
I feel like we finally get to record a conversation that we've had ongoing for a couple of years now. I'm very excited about that.
It's true. And like on a variety of formats, like I think if we combine texts, emails, G-chats, like all of it, it'll make a great archive for this conversation.
I, of course, love to have you talk about The Expanse because you bring your entire career and all your extracurricular interests to bear here. I know you're a big science fiction nerd, and also you're a professional political scientist. Is that how you describe, to someone say someone is a political scientist?
You can say political scientist, although you do tend to get mocked a little bit when you say that. I mean, you know, the standard thing is I'm a political scientist, and then someone will say, "Hey, you know how something's not a science because they put science in the title?" At which point, I then say, "Computer scientist," boom, and then walk away. But yeah, no, it's I'm a political scientist.
Let's look at the geopolitics of The Expanse, which is, I think, one of the most interesting things that gets laid out really clearly in season one. Mm-hmm. It's what sets the foundation for the entire show. Everything is a little unfamiliar. Every item here is familiar in a some way historical sense, but also has a twist.
That is correct. The way I would put it is that, you know, so my area of expertise is international relations primarily. So, you know, what I am studying is the geopolitics of the planet Earth, as it were. And what The Expanse does extremely well is essentially take it and expand the sort of arena of politics. It's no longer just one planet. It's now the solar system.
I was going to ask you if we should call it geopolitics or something else, but I don't know what that word would be.
I'm sure there's some fancy astronomy word for like solar system as a unit of analysis, but you know, there we go.
Then again, geo is rock, right? So, and everything involved has a rock element to it.
And to be fair, a lot of what we're talking about is really about extractive resources. So yeah, it's entirely fair.
That's a way to make people really excited about the show, by the way, if you tell them it's about labor unions and extractive industry. People are like, oh, let me watch that. But there's also love stories and shooting and everything like that. Well, let's start where the geo really begins, which is Earth. In this future timeline, which is about 200 years in the future, according to canon, Earth is now kind of one country governed by the UN. That might be the first place where you and I can laugh a little bit. That seems like an unlikely future, but we're lifting the weight of disbelief. The other thing that's really interesting, I think, for us here in late capitalism is the idea that Earth is now not only just governed by the UN, but it has an enormous welfare state, which is really important to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we seeing historical parallels here? Like, what is the state of Earth right now? What can we look at in the past and be like, that is what Earth is like?
Well, there are ways. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things about The Expanse in some ways is that in contrast to a lot of other science fiction, what they've really done is sort of taken what you might consider just literally current trends and extrapolated them two centuries in. So there's still behavior that is recognizable to us. For example, The Expanse is one of the only shows where you see people looking at their phones in the same way that we do now, which I always liked. And maybe that'll be different 200 years from now, but who knows? But in terms of the size of the welfare state, there's an argument to be made that really all they're doing is a straight line projection from the last 150 years or so, which is to say the role of the state, you know, in terms of both the national economy and in the global economy, it's been an uninterrupted rise. you know, first with the creation of large militaries, but then with the creation of first relatively small welfare states, and then post Great Depression and World War II, the creation of much larger welfare states. And the ironic thing is that for all the talk, for example, in the United States about how, oh, you know, Republicans over the last 20, 30 years, you know, have re-embraced the free market and have really tried to reduce the welfare state, federal government expenditures as a percent of GDP are still at like close to all-time highs. You're still talking about 25% or higher. What Republicans have done essentially is just cut taxes. So we're now running much larger deficits than we used to. But in terms of the state providing a larger welfare payments and Social Security and so on and so forth, that's not terrifically surprising. And furthermore, the politics of this, it even in 2019, is that anytime you see a government trying to cut back on benefits that it normally provides, you get protests either in the ballot box or on the street.
And is there some historical parallel here, like an empire so wealthy that the way that it controls its population control? And I do, control is an important word here, right? Because there are these masses, they have a limited amount of labor that can be done. That's one of the fascinating things about Earth politics here, is that people dream of joining the workforce. The most Earthers are in fact on what is called basic, and it's a rare few people that rise into the, literally, I guess you could call it working class. It means something entirely different.
I mean, what you can argue potentially is that, I mean, again, that's relatively consistent with the idea that, you know, think about concerns about automation, you know, now in the workplace, the idea that essentially the few workers that are left are so productive that you don't need that many of them. And so there's always this fear, you know, that economists tend to dismiss, and I do tend to agree with them. But nonetheless, the fear is that, you know, there are sectors that are so productive that you don't need that many workers in them. Think agriculture, where in the United States, you know, 150 years ago, the predominant employment in the United States was you were a farmer. Now, the percentage of the American workforce that's that are in agriculture is something like less than 2%. This doesn't mean that we're not producing enough food. We're actually producing way more food than we need. And the same is true with respect to manufacturing. You can argue if services become, you know, equally automated, the need for actual labor in order to be able to provide things becomes less and less. Of course, it's a question of how you pay for things, but that's a separate conversation. So in terms of the sort of historical parallels, I will say that the one thing that keeps coming back to me now is, in some ways, we're talking about the Gulf Sheikhdoms. These are places that are essentially so wealthy that to the extent they do need labor, they wind up importing them from elsewhere. But their actual citizens barely do that much. So, for example, you know, there's no, you know, if you think about the Saudi military or the Emirati military, that those are staffed by entirely by citizens. But beyond that, you know, and beyond sort of government functions in terms of the private sector, it's not like there's a lot of people who are working. And it, furthermore, most citizens in these places get massive amounts of benefits because the governments can afford them. Now, in return, of course, they don't have things like voting rights. So, you know, there's obviously a significant trade-off here. And there's a large underclass. In the case of the Gulf, it's from people who are essentially imported from South Asia and elsewhere to do all of the actual hard work.
Why is it important that Earth has this particular setup in order for all the other parts of the expanse to kind of fall the way that they do?
So the key thing about the sort of setup of the expanse is that you have to understand that Earth is on the decline. Essentially, there was no denying that clearly, you know, Earth was in the parlance of international relations, the hegemon. It was the most powerful actor. And it still is, I think, you know, even at the time of the start of the expanse, the most powerful actor in the solar system. But also everyone is keenly aware of the trajectory, which is they are on the decline. Relative to Mars in particular. But the idea is that the current model that they're engaging in isn't sustainable, that they can't necessarily maintain all these welfare payments. And I think the other element of this, and again, in some ways, this does parallel the sort of Gulf Sheikhdom, is that I think a lot of the other actors in the show perceive of Earth as the most spoiled people on the face of the solar system, because they are the only ones with a blue sky, as constantly, you know, it's one of the constant refrains of the show. So in contrast to life on the belt or life on Mars, you know, residents of Earth take it for granted that they can breathe air, which does raise interesting questions about ecologically what they've done. But the point being, that it's good to know. I think I wrote when I wrote a column about this for the Washington Post, I thought the most cheering thing about The Expanse was the belief that Earth would still be around 200 years from now.
That we would climate actually change. Still have. Somehow they've solved climate change. That's actually one of the other elements that we have to sort of lift the veil of disbelief is that somehow climate change is not a factor.
But fair enough. I mean, look this way. Maybe climate change was a factor, but it's not as big of a factor. Or like they do find a technological way of dealing with it. But the point is, the key thing that matters in terms of the sort of dynamics of The Expanse is that Earth and Mars have a geopolitical rivalry. Mars is on the rise and Earth is on the decline. And so in the form of international relations, we call that a possible power transition. And generally speaking, in the history of great power politics, power transitions don't end well. They usually end in war.
Yes, foreshadowing here. The other thing I think is important about Earth being on the decline, one of the ways it's on the decline that's really important to the politics The Expanse is that it's out of resources.
Right, exactly. So it's clearly tapped out what the sort of raw materials it relies on. And in order to be able to sustain, you know, a lifestyle to which Earthlings are accustomed to, they have to extract resources from, in particular, the belt, you know, including clearly things like water or potable water, I'm assuming, and other possible resources. So, yeah, that's absolutely one of the driving elements. And I think the other driving element, which I think informs not just season one, but also season two of the show, is the attitude of the leadership towards its population, which is, you know, the hero, my favorite character on the show, you know, is Christian Evrosala. I'm mangling her last name, I know. But played magnificently by Shora Agadulu. She's your sort of exemplar of a very competent bureaucrat and leader who is trying to do, you know, the best for Earth. But a lot of the other UN officials that she interacts with, I would argue, almost have a contempt for the population to some extent. And that leads them to, let's say, freelance.
Yes, that is an important part of the show. And maybe we can talk about freelance diplomacy when we talk about parallels to our current political structure.
Oh, God, I hadn't made that connection. That's just scary.
Well, let's move on to Mars. One of my favorite things about this show, and this is a little bit like backstory in the books, but I'm going to say it anyway, is that Mars is populated by Southeast Asians, Texans, and Kiwis, New Zealanders. And part of that has to do with those cultures being kind of exploratory cultures, like willing to like go out and claim land. And other part of it mm-hmm. that doesn't get talked about is actually that is where climate change comes into play. The authors theorize that those are the parts of the Earth that would be overtaken by a sea rise.
Ah, that does make some sense. Or I assume would be, in the case of Texas, be completely inhospitable.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that's one of the backstories of Mars, is that it's been settled by a few different cultures. And I guess it turns out Texans are predominant because, and also as a native Texan myself, like I'm weirdly proud of this. But it's an incredible, I don't want to use the word macho because I think it's not necessarily a gendered thing at Mars. But there is a sense of
swagger.
Can we say swagger? Sure, swagger that we Americans tend to associate with the West, tend to associate with again
with the American West.
With the American West, yes. With our ancestors that went off and built the railroads and you know tamed the planet. Indeed,
right.
Tamed the planet.
No, it's a pioneer spirit in the sense of you know these are people who have left the old world, in this case, literally, to create something new. Knowing the backstory in some ways, that also helps to explain further the sort of Martian attitude towards Earth, with the idea that they, in some ways, had no choice; they had to leave. But you know, the idea that they are committed to you know a planet that they are, and I think one of the other drivers of this, obviously, is that Martians very much want to create a blue sky. They are committed to terraforming their world. And you know, you hear this throughout the show, the idea that within the next generation or two, they will be able to, you know, look up and see a blue sky on Mars.
And this is important also driving season four, actually, is that,
oh, really?
Yeah, well, because let's see, I guess we're going to assume everyone who's listening has already kind of consumed everything that they can about the show. But because when the gates open, there are tons of planets with blue skies.
Right.
So Mars's identity is in a real crisis.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yes. And certainly makes some sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Because right now in season one, that is definitely the Mars identity is a sense of pioneering spirit. But also we talked about the leadership of Earth's contempt for the population. Mars's contempt for Earth in general.
Yes.
Is super important to the way that they think about the universe.
And it is interesting because, I mean, I don't know. I mean, at least on the television show, you know, full disclosure, I have not read the novels. In some ways, I like to be surprised by what I see on the show. But you don't hear that much about internal Martian politics. The only thing you hear on the show is basically essentially there almost are no politics in the sense of there's so much social solidarity on Mars that it obviates the need for politics. They're all, for lack of a better way of putting it, marching on, you know, to the same tune. They're all marching in the same direction.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a fascistic way. I mean that in the sense of they're actually literally all committed to the same project.
Although it's a martial culture. Right. I mean, I think I don't know if this is canon, but it seems like military service is, if not compulsory, then something that a lot of people do. And maybe it's some kind of service requirement. I bet that's what it is. Is either you have to join a civil force or the military. I can imagine that's how it works.
This is going to be controversial. If you have to do a parallel to what would Martian politics look like on Earth, I think the parallel to Israel is the founding of Israel, actually. In the sense of you suddenly have people coming from various forms of diaspora. They all, you know, show up in the same place. They are, you know, they face relatively harsh environmental conditions to start off with and feel somewhat insecure. But, you know, have this very strong Zionist, belief in the idea of founding a state that will survive and thrive.
Yeah, that may be controversial, but it sounds exactly right. Although that will sidebar sometime at some point, I want to discuss the theology of the Expanse, which comes up in season three.
Yeah, here we go.
So now that we've kind of sketched out Mars and Earth, which are the two superpowers of the Expanse, let's move on to the Belters, who are the culture that actually the Expanse kind of centers on. Like it's the fate of the Belt that most concerns our protagonists, for sure. And it's the future.
Well, not to mention, and also most of the action on the show takes place out on the Belt. Yeah.
Right. And it's what happens to the Belt that kind of directs the show, the show's arc. And the Belt is where we get introduced right away in the books and in the series as well. Like the action kind of starts in the Belt. One of the things that I found fascinating about it right away, what drew me into the story almost right away, is this idea that we've created another, I don't want to use the word race, but they are genetically the same, but they are physiologically different. And there's a class of people who are laborers. Yeah.
Right. No. So, I mean, one of the things I do love about the show is that, particularly with respect to the Belters, is there is a clear interaction between the sort of geography of the places they're inhabiting and the culture. One of the things, and I will say the show is uncompromising in this, and it does require a little bit of effort on the part of the viewer. But, you know, when you are first exposed to the sort of Belter dialogue, it takes a little getting used to understand what the heck they're saying. And also the degree to which, for example, in many cases, their communication is through hand signals, through tattoos and so on and so forth, which also makes sense given that a lot of what they have to do in terms of their labor, they're in spacesuits. So it makes communication that much more difficult. And if memory serves, like one of the plot points for season one in particular is our sort of entryway into the Belter world is through Detective Miller, who is a sort of cop, perhaps a semi-corrupt one. One of the things he does that just ticks off everyone is he wears a hat.
Yes. It's one of the Phillips of the first season that makes it a kind of semi-noir. My favorite genre, my mini favorite mini genre of all time is a detective story set in space. So this totally hits all my pleasure buttons. And
so this is your jam, basically.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, totally. And I love that that's kind of how Miller's story is set up. And he most resembles kind of a John D. McDonald character, Lou Archer, who is makes compromises, let's say, ethically sometimes. But ultimately is trying to do the right thing, which I think Miller is too.
The parallel I kept thinking of, which again is also fraught with controversy now, but I kept thinking of Jack Vincennes in L.A. Confidential.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that too. I mean,
it's the same thing.
He's definitely caught in a system that does not reward obeying every rule. The Belter culture, there is a sense of it's kind of a anarchic libertarian at the same time social democratic ethos.
Well, it's fragmented would be the best thing to say. I mean, you know, so we, you know, politically the governance in the Belt is a little unclear, because we know that on the one hand what drives their economy is Earth and Mars buying their raw materials, but we're also keenly aware that in some ways it's the extraction is clearly done by corporations that are probably linked more closely to Earth and Mars than to the Belt itself. There is this outer, you know, there's the OPA, which is the Outer Planets Alliance. Their actual governance is somewhat murky and unclear, and also deeply factionalized. And there's a high degree of cynicism even among the OPA people about the OPA,
mm-hmm.
And about their ability to actually organize. And so the part of the Belt that's fascinating to me is, for lack of a way of putting it, by and large, the sense of resignation among a mm-hmm. lot of the people who are out there of, yeah, this is our life. And it's not like they're thrilled about it. They have plenty they can complain about, but they're also – you know, I think even a lot of the people who are not clearly within the OPA are cynical about what the OPA is trying to do.
Yes, although it's they have such an interesting sense of solidarity despite all this,
right.
all these factions. And I think that goes back to the fact that they are different as a people,
yeah.
like physiologically mm-hmm. different. They have a different language. They are born of a specific type of labor. And
right.
that is why I keep telling everybody, like, it's the most interesting show about labor politics on television. Maybe the only show about labor politics on television currently, on American television, at least, except for like season 2 of The Wire, I guess. Maybe that's the only other one I can think of. The Docs season of The Wire, which is 2 or 3.
There you go. For lack of a way of putting it, it's a show that takes, and I know that as a social scientist, this is like a really high compliment, and I have no idea what this means for everyone else, but it's a show that takes geography, sociology, and political economy really goddamn seriously.
I want to spend just a little more time getting to the Belt, which is that they are sort of the engine. The Belt, the future of the Belt, is the engine of the show. Are they a colony, or are they a union? What do you think of how their place in the universe drives the show?
I think the way you have to look at it at the beginning of the show is they are a colony, in the sense of they are clearly part of what you would consider either the Earth or Martian empire. And one of the things to realize about imperial politics generally is that imperial politics is not this notion of, oh, there's a metropole and you know, they will assign a governor who will be put in charge of this particular colony. It's often much looser and far less legalistic than that. So very often, you know, the pattern of colonization very often in the on Earth was that potential colonizers would befriend local elites, usually minority populations, as a way of then extending control over the larger place. But that didn't necessarily even mean that they actually had control. They just sort of, you know, controlled the commanding heights, as it were, of the local economy. And I think to some extent you see that in the crew that we're introduced to, at the beginning of the show, of the Rocinante. And but also more generally, also in terms of what Miller, how Miller deals with, his world, which is there's a police force and, you know, if things get really bad, they will exert force. But other than that, you know, the Belters have significant amounts of autonomy because there's only so much that the authorities can do.
And of course, the other thing that gets the plot in motion, and maybe this is the real MacGuffin, as we would say in a detective story, is the proto-molecule.
Right. The protomolecule that in some ways starts the, you know, it's the MacGuffin. It's what causes, you know, various actors to be put into play. And it clearly has relatively powerful effects on people who get exposed to it, needless to say.
Yes. And so what are the effects? We'll talk about the effects of the people on the people maybe in the next show. But how does it destabilize the geopolitics of the show?
I mean, so the clear thing that the protomolecule does is that it essentially eviscerates anything that it comes into contact with, or rather reformulates it. The sci-fi parallel, which is sounds weird, is that I always think of that as the Genesis device from Star Trek II. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the way it's different here is that it seems to be naturally discovered. Even though it's not, there's clearly an intelligence to it. But I think the way that the actors in The Expanse react to it is the same way they would react to a weapon of mass destruction. That the way you have to or a potential weapon of mass destruction. So it's something that can potentially generate tremendous amounts of destructive power. It is also, as we will find out, you know, I think when we talk about season two, in theory, it could have also done a few other things. But the way that you have to think about it is that the moment you appreciate what the protomolecule can do when it comes in contact with humans or Martians or Belters is that it's a weapon of mass destruction. And the moment you realize that it's a weapon of mass destruction, every actor wants to get their hands on it.
And that is kind of where we end season one, is with the knowledge that it's a weapon of mass destruction and that it has been deployed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a contest for who's going to control it.
Right. And the other thing is, to be fair, it's in not just a weapon of mass destruction. It's also very much in the early stages of weapons of mass destruction, where, you know, we are talking now in a time where the sort of logic of nuclear deterrence, for example, it's pretty well understood by everyone, the notion of mutually assured destruction. This was not obvious necessarily at the time that atomic weapons were initially developed. And indeed, at the time when they were developed, the mindset of many, even people in the military who had them was they're just a weapon like anything else. So that sort of recognition of what it could do only emerges slowly over time. And the other element of this that we should talk about, I think, to close out season one is that it's also not that – or it's also that it's a private actor, not necessarily a representative of the state, that is interested in developing this or weaponizing it, as it were.
Yeah, we didn't really get to corporations, but they, again, in season two, the power of a corporation comes into play as an even potentially more powerful actor than states. We'll talk protogen and protomolecule and what it does to people in both a metaphorical and literal sense in the next episode. I guess see you later, Dan.
See you later, Anna. Looking forward to the further conversation.
And that is it for this episode. If you liked it, there's a lot more to come. 12 more episodes, in fact. And if you liked it, please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review us. Do all the things. And if your thirst for my voice needs to be further slaked, you can always check out The Other Thing I Do with friends like these. Until next time.